watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. My name is Simon Brown. Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss will be joining us in this evening to guide us through the latest news on global markets. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Peter Little from Anchor Capital to discuss their Sanlam Global Stable Fund. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, here's a quick look at what's been making headlines. What we first off is that U.S. trade war within China is on hold, and after a surprise concession from China, China dropped its anti-dumping probe into imports of U.S. sorghum. Trade in sorghum is worth over $1 billion, was halted last year. The world's two largest economies have meanwhile agreed to drop their tariff threats whilst they work on a broader trade agreement. The move came hours after U.S. officials said China was offering to slash the U.S. trade deficit by up to $200 billion. The deficit was $375 billion last year. Progress in the U.S.-China trade war talks has sent oil prices within sight of last week's November 2014 highs. Analysts, however, have expressed ease with the supply and demand dynamics despite ongoing production cuts led by OPEC and looming U.S. sanctions against major oil producer Iran. And on the company news front, e-commerce sales rebounded at Walmart, helping revenue beat expectations, while JCPenney's flat same-store sales fell far short of targets. Here's more on that.
Walmart's e-commerce business bounced back, helping quarterly revenue rise and beat expectations. E-commerce sales at the world's largest retailer shot up 33%, a turnaround from the sharp slowdown in the holiday season. Walmart's CFO said online grocery sales continued to accelerate and the revamp of the company's website helped, as did the introduction of new brands through its partnership with department store chain Lord & Taylor. Earlier this month, Walmart agreed to buy Indian e-commerce firm Flipkart so it can better compete with Amazon.com. Consumer Edge analyst David Schick said, e-commerce trends are the near-term focus of investors driven by Walmart.com and online grocery strength. Our analysis of digital traffic had suggested some acceleration. Sales at existing stores in the U.S. rose in line with expectations. Over at JCPenney, same-store sales were nearly flat and fell far short of Wall Street's targets. The department store operator blamed unusually cool weather in April for crimping demand for spring clothing. Penny's net loss was wider than expected, and it cut its full-year profit forecast. Shares of JCPenney tumbled at the market open Thursday, while Walmart's rose.
Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss joining me in studio. Gary, thanks for your time this evening. I don't know which one to kick off on. I suppose let's go with Walmart. Not bad numbers. The key point the market was really looking for was that online component, which up nicely, but obviously a lower base, beating expectations, and that's really the going head-to-head with Amazon if we take bricks and mortar as like last year's way of retail.
Absolutely, and I think that's really the focus for Walmart now, is to try and convince the market that they have the ability to transition into an online retailer. And you kind of look at the headline numbers on Amazon's growth versus Walmart's growth. Amazon were just almost 40%, Walmart growing at 4.1%. I mean, it's a significant difference. And most analysts are saying that kind of brick and mortar, chain stores that Walmart have are going to be a severe hindrance. But there's perhaps a good argument to be made that if they can convert those correctly to either pickup points or central distribution
warehousing
in a sense, exactly right, this could be a significant competitive advantage for them. So, it's still bigger than Amazon by profit and sales. I mean, we can't really look at the profit line too much because Amazon doesn't really care about making profit anyway. But it didn't look like a bad set of numbers, and I think you're almost starting to get the sense that this is a company that's waking up. I mean, we saw the Flipkart acquisition as well, and they're waking up. They're trying to get into the e-commerce space. They've seen what Amazon is doing. They know that if they don't do something, Amazon is going to eat their lunch, and it's now head to head.
In a sense, almost. I mean, they're 20 years behind Amazon. Mm. Boy, no, 25 years behind Amazon. That's giving quite a head start to Amazon. But what it does do is Amazon's kind of shown the way in a sense, and given indications of how you do it and what consumers want. For example, Amazon Prime, they've got 100 million users. They knocked that fee up $20. Well, there's a big pile of cash. You get extra revenue. But it gives Walmart a sense of what they need to do to solidly compete.
Absolutely. Amazon might have had that kind of first mover e-commerce advantage, but certainly Walmart, just because of its sheer scale, will be able to implement best practices. Now, Amazon's size as well does give it, almost some impediment as well, because the whole reason, Amazon was looking at Flipkart to get into India. Now, We know Walmart's in there. It's in India, a very exciting market. Amazon couldn't go in because of, most likely because of antitrust regulation. I mean, you know, when you go in and you're Amazon, say, I want to buy Flipkart, oh, wait a minute, you're going to be 90% of the market. Suddenly, there's a space for Walmart. And it does look like Walmart is going to be kind of the official opposition of Amazon. And that's not a bad place
to
be.
Not a bad place. I would be happy with number two to Amazon.
And especially if you look at the potential for e-commerce growth. So, I mean, this was a study done by FTI. I mean, you're looking at 2016 in the U.S. This is U.S. E-commerce sales, $395 billion. They're projecting out to 2020 at $523 billion, and by 2027, $1 trillion in e-commerce sales. So you're seeing probably, what, three times growth in e-commerce sales? Like, as you say, number two, not a bad spot to be in that kind of environment.
In India, plus a billion people, relatively modest low penetration of internet, probably where the U.S. was in percentage terms of internet penetration 10 or 15 years ago. If you can become number one or even a tie in India, that can become Walmart could almost become an Indian company.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say 10 to 15 years, it could even be deeper than that.
Sure.
I mean, if you look at e-commerce sales kind of as a percentage of trade in India, I think it only makes up about 4% of total retail sales. So it's a very, very small component with a huge amount of potential growth. And, you know, while there's a lot of criticism that, you know, Walmart potentially overpaid for Flipkart, which is fantastic
for
news
holders.
For NASPAS holders and a couple of other of the original shareholders in Flipkart. But it's it certainly has given them a unique position in the Indian market, which is a difficult market to break into, and a market that is really wrapped up in regulation. So it's I think they've got 100 million customers at the moment in India, and that could grow significantly. I mean, just looking at the figures, and not just in the number of customers, but also the value that the customers are spending.
Quickly before we leave it, Walmart, is it worth looking at now, or do we wait for it to start proving a little more metal, a few more quarters under the belt?
We own Amazon in portfolios. We don't own Walmart at the moment, but certainly it is something that has come up in investment committee discussions, and it's something that we are looking at because while you don't have the kind of same revenue growth at the moment, that kind of is keeping a bit of a lid on Walmart's price. So you've got to kind of wonder if it's not worth a nibble.
Yeah, but hey, you got number one. So the biggest number, the number that matters right now, U.S. 10-year, 3.1%. I think it hit 3.124. It's pulled back a little bit. This is the number that's been spooking the market. Is this the number that matters, and what do we care? Does it, you know, if it goes to 3.5, does the world end? If it goes back to 2.5, are we all back to the races?
It's a good question. I follow a wonderful economist at UBS, and his view is I think similar to mine. It's a psychological level, sure. And people look at it because it makes nice headlines. But is the real world changed at 2.9 versus 3.1 any more so than the world has changed with 2.7 versus 2.9?
Yeah, fair point.
Probably not. So it's something that was expected. I mean, we understand that interest rates in the US are rising. I mean, this is an economy that is firing on all cylinders.
Yep.
I mean, we're seeing, basically, we thought it was frictional unemployment, and then it got better. And now it's more than frictional unemployment. You know, any survey of the U.S. labor market at the moment is, companies are saying that they're struggling to find talent. They're having to pay up. You're going to start seeing wage inflation coming into the system. This is an economy that's running very, very hot. You look at the earnings season last quarter as well. I mean, EPS growth of, it's 20%, north of 20%,
yep,
even on average on S&P 500 companies. This is an economy firing on all cylinders. Interest rates should potentially be a little bit higher than they are.
And best EPS growth since, I think, October, since the third quarter of 2010. Before we head off, trade wars, so we were going to have trade wars, the world was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
It started with $50 billion. It was a little confusing exactly what it was and wasn't, and I hear you. But suddenly over the weekend, all's happy again, although the China seems to have made some concessions. But it's one thing to say we'll buy an extra $200 billion of US stuff. It's another thing to actually write the check.
It's very difficult to understand how they're going to do it. So even if you look at all the, vastly improving, probably airline purchases,
sure,
as a component, energy purchases and raw materials, you get to about $100 billion, and you're still pretty short. And at the same time, I mean, again, there's another argument to be made. It's actually very easy to narrow a trade deficit like that. You just transport the location of the final component of the manufacturing to a different country, and suddenly it changes all the numbers because that's how it's measured. So make most of the components in the supply chain in China, but the final component you don't do in China, that'll tweak the number as well. So you know, this whole argument around, you know, trade tariffs and that, tariffs are a mechanism that were, you know, for me, it's a mechanism that worked very well in maybe the 18th and 19th centuries. But,
yeah.
You know, if you look at the complex supply chains that we have internationally, I mean, there's a wonderful Economist article that shows it's the manufacturer of a seating component for a car, and how many times it was in the context of NAFTA, how many times it crosses between the U.S. and Mexico in the manufacture of a simple seating component. I mean, sure, there's electronics involved, but it's something like 15 different times. I mean, you can't just slap tariffs in and expect things to not grind to a halt.
Which time do you count it? The third time? The tenth time? Every time?
It's a very, very complex process, and it makes great headlines. And I mean, we understand that, you know, I think this you know, de-escalation that we've seen in the talks today, which has got markets a little bit excited, it probably needs to happen while they discuss the framework. But I think, you know, what really has us concerned is that, you know, you've got congressional elections coming up in November. Yeah. And you know, if you look at states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, this is the states that really they thrive on that kind of Trump rhetoric around we will clamp down on China, we will label China a currency manipulator, and that sort of thing. And that, you know, leads us to believe that potentially this is not going to be the end of the trade wars or the tensions with China. And
half a minute before break, oil retreating a bit. Does oil in the 70s bother you? Do you think it's sustainable?
So if I listen to Vivi's the perma bear on oil, so I say bear, I mean going up. I sort of think of optimistically that oil might fall. But you know, looking at it, I think you certainly with the geopolitical tensions in Iran, you could easily see a spike up to even $100 a barrel. Longer term, there is a lot of shale production that can still come
ultimately.
On. If you listen to the Bob Dudley, CEO of BP, talking, they see oil between sort of, you know, $50 and $65 a barrel as the supply comes back online. And this kind of trade tensions with Iran, just traders speculating ahead of it. And partially the supply freeze out of OPEC and Russia.
Yeah, so short-term pain, long-term
a bit of a settling down.
So walk for the next couple of months and then we go back to driving. Taking a short break when we come back, we'll take a look at Anchor Capital Sanlam Stable Fund with Peter Little. Don't go away. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor, still in studio with me. Of course, we've got Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss and joined now by Peter Little from Anchor Capital. Peter, thanks for joining us. We're going to be talking your Anchor Global Stable Fund. The first point I want to kick off on, I look at a lot of these fact sheets and they always give the risk between low, mid-low, moderate, high. And they're always either low or high. Yours comes bang in the middle. I don't know if I've ever seen a moderate fund before. So assuming probably most of our viewers haven't either, where does a moderate fund position into an overall portfolio?
Yeah, Simon, thanks for having me here tonight. So when we looked at setting this up probably 4 or 5 years ago when I joined Anchor, most of our clients who'd decided to expatriate their savings and take dollars offshore were invested predominantly in equities. And I think that was a familiarity thing. I think guys were more comfortable with company names they'd heard of. South Africans tend to be pretty au fait with investing in equities, but that risk profile didn't necessarily meet everyone's needs. But on the flip side of that, you had this sort of, at that time, I think US 10-year bond yields were about 2%. And despite the fact that was actually a positive real return of 1% or so, I think South Africans couldn't get their heads around investing in something that gave you such a such a low absolute return. So bond funds, you know, particularly on an after-fee basis, were not particularly appealing. And so we sort of ended up going with something that put enough growth assets in there. So about a quarter of the portfolio is in equities, about 10% in real estate. So there's enough growth assets in there so that you get a bit of growth for your capital, but also not, you know, all the way out on your risk spectrum for those guys who have a bit of more of a capital preservation focus.
Capital preservation, less growth, and as you say, 1% real is real in America. Here we're not so excited about it. If we drill into it, I mean, your top holdings, and we'll talk equities in a second, you've got some S&P, you've got some short-term corporate bonds, mostly sitting in government bonds. Now, obviously, there's a lot more to it, but that weighting is quite high in the government bond space. Chatting with Gary a moment ago, 10-year above 3, hitting 3.124, coming back below 3.1. Are you stressing about these numbers, or are you quite sanguine with them?
No, I think, frankly, it's looking quite interesting for the first time in ages. I mean, at over 3%, you've got, as I say, about 1% of U.S. Inflation's running just over 2% at the moment. So you've got about a percent of real return there. I think probably it's more interesting at the front end of the curve. So U.S. two-year bonds, which sort of at the middle of last year would have been around 1.5%, they're now giving you 2.5%. So you don't actually have to take on that much duration and interest rate risk at the 10-year point to get a decent yield at this stage. So yielding assets for the first time in ages, I think, are starting to look a bit more attractive, certainly for the point in the cycle that we're at.
Yeah, so that's a fair point. We've just come out of S&P 500 earnings, a good quarter by any metric, a solid quarter from that. We can park trade wars and the like aside. We can maybe come back to them in a bit, but certainly good results out there. But however you spin it, this bull market is long in the tooth. And I'm not saying it's over, but it's certainly surely closer to an end than the beginning. Does that give you a bias perhaps away from equity to a degree, or are you more going to wait for an event and then sort of lower the equity weighting?
I think it's always difficult to time these things. As you say, we're almost certainly closer to the next recession than we are from the last one.
Which gives us a 10-year window, of course.
Exactly. So I think we're 10 years in. I think the last three or four, the average has been 8 years, so we're longer. There's obviously many arguments for and against why this could be longer than usual. But the point is, no, it's very few people see these recessions coming in advance.
Sure.
So to say I'm going to pick the catalyst that's going to drive me into bonds is, that's quite a low probability event. So my bias is towards, as you sort of get long in the tooth in this cycle, to make sure that you have the protection there and not try and sort of switch out of equities into bonds at the right time. So I think we're getting towards the time where, as I say, yields are looking more attractive. We're certainly heading, I don't think a recession is imminent, but we're certainly heading in that direction at some point in the next couple of years. And I think, you know, sort of keeping a stable allocation for at least for that portion of savings that people care about capital preservation or have a slightly sorted duration, it's a good time to be there.
Gary, I'm not sure how many of your clients are capital preservation fans, but I mean, are you still, you know, guns blazing, or are you getting nervous is the wrong word, but perhaps a little circumspect in the offshore, particularly in the US?
Yeah, I think we really take it on a client by client basis. So it kind of depends on the risk profile of the client, and certainly we've seen a lot of interest in kind of our capital protected products as well. We're working with a lot of the different institutional houses looking for some of that kind of equity upside, but just, you know, giving them some capital protection at the same time, because absolutely, once you're sitting in an 8-year bull market, to look forward and say over the next 5 years I'm pretty certain the market's going to be higher, it becomes more difficult, and especially if you're sitting at kind of retirement age.
Yeah, that's a point.
And you need
different,
and you need
if you're 30 or 60.
Absolutely, if you've got a 20-25 year time horizon, no problem. You know, time in the market, absolutely. You know, buy equities, because you don't know that this market's not going to run for another 4 years. But when you start to get towards retirement, you know, having maybe a 3.5 year structure where you know that you are going to get at least a 4% return that can still capture some equity market upside, I mean, that's kind of where we're positioning our clients. I mean, we have looked at kind of the likes of stable funds and that as well for our client base. I mean, it's just interesting. Maybe I can just pose a question to you, Pete, as well. Like, when you kind of move into the offshore spaces, which is really where our clients kind of like to play, obviously you've got much lower inflation, much lower return environments as well, yet it doesn't seem like performance fees or at least management fees shift, whether you're in rand or in dollars. I mean, is that the right way of thinking about it? As we bring down the risk, should we not also bring down the fees to an extent?
I mean, I guess I think it's a tough question, but yeah. I kind of think of the skill required. Like, you should pay less if you think you're getting less skill, is generally the way I think about it. And if you think that there's less skill required to earn returns offshore, then you should probably pay less for it, rather than slicing up the pie of available real returns, which is somewhat arbitrary, I guess.
In terms of geography, you're a global fund, and therefore there's a planet out there. Do you say we like the US, or we like Europe or a particular region and go and hunt, or are you fairly agnostic, particularly, you know, whether it be in your bonds, perhaps whether it be in the equity, are you just, if this is quality enough, geography doesn't bother you, and currency for that matter, because of course there's different currencies at play?
Yeah, so because it's a conservative fund, I tend to stick to the developed markets, focus on US and Europe, Japan, much less of a focus on the emerging markets. So we're looking for opportunities on those. I prefer to be diversified, so All of these countries go through cycles, and again, timing them is pretty tough, so we want exposure to most of them. To answer your question on currencies, the fund's denominated in dollars, and I try not to take currency bets unless I have a strong view against that. So my default will be to hedge everything back into dollars unless we really think that there's a strong reason not to be in dollars at that point.
And is the fund mostly, therefore, in the U.S., be it in treasuries or in equities?
So in the fixed income space, a lot of what's available, liquid and high quality, tends to be U.S. dollar denominated. Euro and GBP is sort of the next set of good supply. So a lot of the fixed income stuff tends to be U.S. dollar focused. In the equity space, again, I mean, probably half of global capital markets is U.S., so you sort of default into that. That anyway, particularly if you're going for high quality companies that tend to be U.S. domiciled, even though they're not, you know, focused on the domestic markets in the U.S., they tend to be listed there.
Geopolitics, we're chatting with Gary. Trade wars, we had the ZTE story break last Monday, or perhaps it was Sunday. Certainly, obviously, the Iran story, North Korea, will they or won't they meet on the 12th of June? How much is that informing your decision? Certainly, my sense is that with Brexit, with Trump in the White House, there's a lot more geopolitical going down than there perhaps was 3 years ago. And maybe that's just too much Twitter for me. How much is that factoring in it? Or again, if this is a solid company or a good treasury, the geopolitics can play their game, the quality will come through.
Yeah, I think the latter. I think you have a lot of noise around these trade wars, and obviously they will have an impact on the economy. But again, trying to sort of time in and out of companies that might or might not be affected on a short-term basis, pretty tough game. So we try to look through most of the noise and look to see more, is it going to have a long-term impact on the economic cycle, which trade wars probably will. They're probably not good for global growth. So it's more going to inform our view on perhaps the length of the cycle than it is on trying to pick specific companies that might benefit from these things.
We've got a couple of minutes to go. Your top 10 holdings are all either some futures and mostly T-bills and the like. Equity space, what are some of your bigger equity holdings?
So I tend to pick off, we have a couple of guys, Dave Gibb and Nick Dennis, who run global equity funds for us. I tend to just incorporate their equity picks into the fund, and then I just equal weight it. So I try not to have too much stock-specific risk in the company, so in the fund itself. So you're very rarely going to see single equity position sizes of more than a percent and a half. So there's not huge concentrations in that. And it tends to be more of the value bias names, which haven't really worked this year much. Unless you were in Amazon and most of the tech stocks, you've struggled to make money. But yeah, it'll be the big global corporates, the JP Morgans, the Royal Dutch Shells, the sort of bellwether corporates.
Last question for people looking at this. This is domiciled in Ireland. It's U.S. dollar. So you're buying with offshore money outside the borders of the country. You're not buying this in South Africa as well.
Exactly. This is specifically for South African investors, but it's for investors who've used their allowance to get money out the country and now have hard currency to invest with.
We'll leave it there. That's the show for this week. My thanks to our guests, Gary Boyson, Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, and Peter Little, Fund Manager at Anchor Capital. Thanks so much for the insights. Thank you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye and good night.